morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Our foul ball president claims he has hit a home run when most of the rest of us are afraid it might be the third out in the ninth inning. Donald Trump's boast that he could shoot anyone on a New York City street and no one would care probably won't play well with his mafia boss-style missile murder that brings us to the brink of war at the start of 2020. There is an absurdist irony to the Greek Prime Minister's visit with Trump on the day Greece's ancient enemy from classical times, Persia, fired missiles on American soldiers in much the manner their early Iron Age ancestors hurled spears at Greek hoplites at Thermopylae and Marathon. Before Americans are induced to regard the people of Iran as mortal enemies, it might be wise to comprehend how all this dark rancor and vengefulness began. Trump has used the 1979 hostage crisis as a prime center point for atavistic grievance against Iran, but that is only part of the story, and at best quite one-sided. Here is the rest of the story. An American Coup by Vic Campbell. In the first half of the 20th century, there was a great struggle toward democracy in Iran. Following a 50-year effort to form a parliament, write a constitution, develop a division of power between monarch and prime minister, one man emerged capable of leading the country into an era of democratic government. He cared passionately for the future of democracy and self-sufficiency in Iran and fought tirelessly for it. Then, on August 19, 1953, the CIA overthrew his government and installed one favorable to the dethroned Shah. The CIA toppled a new and fragile democracy in Iran, and how that newly formed agency became an instrument of U.S. foreign policy used to undermine undesirable governments throughout the world. Unlike most borders in the Middle East drawn arbitrarily by the British in their colonial period, Iran's reflected a cohesive culture that extends back thousands of years. A Persian Empire Shiite Islamic rule, dominate nation by Ottoman Turks, all shape the Iranian character and its desire for independence and self-rule. In the mid-20th century, various cultural themes, sometimes volatile, sometimes conflicting, coalesced from this complex history to form Iran's first few steps toward democracy. And one man was playing a pivotal role in that effort. Mohammad Mossadegh was an immensely popular figure in Iran at the time of his overthrow. He was born into an aristocratic family, was politically brilliant from a young age, was fiercely principled, a towering intellect, and he loved his country so passionately that he stirred the hearts and minds of Iranians. He was educated, schooled in more than one culture. He was articulate, capable of stirring oratory and convincing debate. And he was incorruptible, refusing to take payments, even sometimes a salary, for his political work. He was, in short, the kind of charismatic figure around which a fledgling democracy could rally and succeed. Mossadegh was at the height of his power in the early 1950s. World War II had ended and communism began its ascendancy. It was a time when foreign policy in the West was shaped by a desire to contain communism, and Iran, because it bordered the Soviet Union, was seen as vulnerable to a communist takeover. Some argued it could become a satellite state that those like those in Eastern Europe. U.S. President Truman felt supporting independent nationalist movements like Mossadegh's that derived their strength from the aspirations of a people to be free and democratic best contained that communism. Great Britain, however, had a long legacy of colonization in Iran. It had struck deals with the petty Turkish monarchs in control of Iran in the 19th century, giving Britain sweeping access to lucrative resource rights there. When oil was discovered, Britain developed a refining industry that shared little of the profits with Iran. Mossadegh argued that his country remained backward and poverty-stricken because of foreign exploitation. And to this end, when he became prime minister, he nationalized the British oil industry in Iran. Britain needed Iranian oil to fuel its empire, and Prime Minister Winston Churchill was willing to use any means to regain the lost refinery, including undermining Mossadegh's administration through covert means. Then, as now, diplomatic embassies played a role in espionage. They were places where intelligence operatives could be cultivated and where information could be passed to home governments under the twin cloaks of secrecy and immunity. When Mossadegh got wind of Britain's clandestine efforts to undercut his regime, he expelled their diplomats and closed the embassy, effectively shutting down Britain's espionage in Iran. Under Truman, the U.S. had refused to collaborate with the British in this matter. However, in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower was elected president, and U.S. foreign policy changed toward Iran. When the British ambassador approached the Eisenhower administration, he was careful to frame a coup in something other than British colonial interests, describing it instead as an effort to stop the expansion of Soviet influence in the region. The British were helped by two prominent members of the new American administration, John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, and Allen Dulles, Director of the CIA. These two brothers ran much of the foreign policy apparatus of the U.S. government, one overtly, the other covertly, working simultaneously and in harmony to realize their staunchly anti-communist views. They no longer wanted an Iran that was merely independent of the Soviet Union. They wanted it completely loyal to the United States. They argued that Iran under Mossadegh was sliding toward instability, chaos, and an eventual Soviet takeover. With the fall of Iran, other countries in the Middle East would suffer the same fate, this in a region that had 60% of the world's oil reserves. Such claims, the veracity of which can never be known, were the motivation for the U.S. president's decision. Using CIA-paid elements of the populace, the Dulles brothers set about destabilizing Iran, in part by using the destabilizing they themselves created as evidence of its need. They convinced Eisenhower it was in the best interest of the U.S. that he approve a coup d'etat, and he did. The coup, codenamed Operation Ajax, deposed the democratically elected government of Mossadegh and restored the Shah to power. By making use of an extensive array of operatives who bribed newspapers and mullahs for support, promised promotions to military officers, and made payments to Iranian organized crime, the CIA exploited inherent vulnerabilities of the young Iranian Republic. It is an intimate portrait of the CIA in its infancy, carrying out its first violent, covert overthrow of a foreign government, and lays blame for the failure of Iranian democracy squarely at the door of the American government. The coup proved so successful that the CIA took center stage in American foreign policy as it again and again attempted, and often succeeded, to overthrow governments such as Guatemala, Cuba, Chile, the Congo, and Vietnam through covert means. Clear exposition of the coup helps to explain the events that followed and why they had such impact on the United States. In 1979, the Iranian people overthrew the Shah, who had become progressively more brutal and repressive, and established a republic. Radical elements infused with anti-American sentiment, created in part by the U.S. role in the coup and its 26-year support of the Shah, co-opted the revolution and imposed an extreme form of fundamentalist Muslim theocracy still in place today. Soon thereafter, Tehran-Iranian students seized the U.S. embassy and took hostages there, an event whose images are still seared into the American psyche. Knowing the CIA had been responsible for toppling Iranian democracy in the 1953 coup, and knowing that embassies are notorious for being centers of espionage, it is not difficult to conclude the Iranian students were acting to prevent another CIA-backed coup, real or imagined. with at all condoning the violent taking and handling of hostages, it can at least be acknowledged that the vitriolic anger of the Iranian people can find some justification in the past actions of the United States. The American coup in Iran in 1953 had violent consequences spanning two generations. This history should make current Middle East policymakers very uneasy. The United States continues to support governments throughout the region that ignore or subvert the hopes of their own people to be free. In the same way that events of modern Iran have come back to haunt the U.S., so may the support of non-democratic governments in the region also invite unwanted compensation and bring those to power who are alienated by and averse to the government of the United States. And the consequences of these acts may be visited not only on this generation, but on its children in unknown ways and proportions. And that was An American Coup by Vic Campbell, who was a resident of Astoria when he wrote this article for the North Coast Times Eagle in 2004 as a review of a book, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup, and the Roots of Middle East Terror by Stephen Kinzer. And now, a poem by Carolyn Dunn. After Great Fear. She starts with another poem by Greek poet George Sepphoris. But again and again, this instinct of the earth, unimaginable how it expands within you, this roaring of blood or sap, we must have been trees in the beginning. And that was Greek poet George Sepphoris, a journal entry of October 24th, 1950. Following acts of violence, we are offered, if we wish, the stillness of alder leaves moving in concert with an easterly wind in the morning. As the wind shifts to the northeast, the leaves bend and hold, a freshness to the light. And this is the image of our lives, the alder leaves in motion to every wind from any quarter, each leaf a turning and response, the tree itself a solid stillness. And that was by Carolyn Dunn. And now, something I wrote, The War President. Election of an American president has always been choosing a wartime dictator. The most important role of the president is as commander-in-chief, which is decorous in peacetime, but Caesarian in wartime. In time of war, it's all power to the president, a newspaper headline once declared. Presidents consolidate their power in wartime, and the impulse is to quell dissent, which is barely tolerated during normal times and quickly repudiated in periods of national crises when dissent is especially necessary. Presidents are given great powers during crises not covered in the Constitution. Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, which allowed military arrest of persons without formally charging them with violating the law. At the end of World War I, U.S. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer extended presidential war powers to conduct the infamous Palmer raids of 1919-1920, in which some 3,000-plus allegedly subversive radical red aliens were rounded up for deportation as communists and radical anarchists, although only about 500 were deported and the rest subsequently released from custody. In a speech to an audience of lawyers, Palmer said, "The war power is of necessity an inherent power in every sovereign nation. It is the power of self-reservation, and that power has no limits other than the extent of the emergency." During World War II, the U.S. interned thousands of Japanese-American citizens. Franklin Roosevelt's infamous Executive Order 9066. After September 11, 2001, President George W. Bush, a fervent believer in the imperial presidency, set up military tribunals for suspected terrorists, both domestic and foreign, which included Afghanis and Iraqi prisoners, whom he refused to grant POW status, and especially immigrants, not unlike the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798-99. 1899, and the McCarran Act of 1950, also against aliens. During the 9/11 induced twin wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Muslim individuals and organizations in the U.S. were targets of surveillance, wiretaps, and inquiry, as well as imprisonment for even the remotest links to terrorist groups. War prisoners from both wars were exported by the U.S. to countries that practiced torture for so-called rendition, an act of rendering so defined. Patriotism is the key word and justification for suspension of civil liberties during wartime and elevation of a president's war powers to nearly a dictatorial level, which points to a flawed weakness of democracy, the tyranny of aroused public opinion, quote unquote, which, if adroitly protracted under the rubric of patriotism, might well lead to broad suppression of civil liberties and invocation of the imperial presidency and forever wars for, quote, the extent of the emergency, unquote, as Palmer defined the duration of war powers. However, as Jack Goldsmith, a legal scholar and Harvard Law School professor, wrote recently in Lawfare, there is a large legal difference between the president's using force in self-defense in an ongoing authorized conflict and the president initiating a conflict not authorized by Congress for largely non-self-defensive reasons. Yet he also wrote that a president and his minions would have an easy time justifying such a first strike, quote, because for many years the executive branch has staked out ever broader theories of presidential uses of force under both domestic and international law, because both political parties in Congress have continually acquiesced to expansion of presidential war powers for the past 30 years, quote, especially with regard to the complex Middle East wars. For example, the unilateral invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq following 9/11. Goldsmith concluded that the USA has, through presidential fiat and congressional submission, given one person, the president, a sprawling military and enormous discretion to use it in ways that can easily lead to a massive war. In short, Professor Goldsmith wrote, that is our system. One person decides. And that was something I wrote. And it is once more obvious that bratty, squalling countries need adult supervision, which the United Nations was created to provide 75 years ago in 1945, at the end of World War II. And it is once again necessary for the World Court to adjudicate international quarrels. Both need to be truly reactivated, or surely the brats are going to blow up the nursery. And it's not too late for a set of New Year's resolutions, which were formulated at the advent of Trumpism. I wrote them initially as a defense of values against the trend of worldwide despotism that Trump's presidency represented from the get-go. Now I repeat them as a counterattack in support of his impeachment and the long and difficult struggle for human rights and liberties Trump and his cabal have attempted to erode and eliminate. First on the list might be a resolution to re-educate yourself and critically examine the fundamentals and history of human rights. Resolve to refuse fables of racial and national supremacy might be the next resolution. Resolve to stand firm against a despotic attempt to reinstate a neo-despotic patriarchy. Resolve to refute current notions that the opposition does not have a right to exist. Resolve to assist holding together a society threatened with dissolving into disorder and inequality by Yankee Doodle apartheid. Resolve that if chaos and disorder devolve upon society by bigoted cleansing campaigns, to retain democracy in the home and in the neighborhood and community. Resolve to not allow and to personally intercede when the essentials of democratic life are threatened. Remember, we have the absolute right to defend our rights. Resolve to understand implicitly that a majority begins with one and flows outward. Resolve to resist one party and or one religion rule in this overwhelmingly multicultural nation, which would destroy democracy more surely than the cancer of onerous economic inequality. Resolve to return the term populist to its rightful definition of the people, which has been tarnished and soiled by right-wing absolutists who wish to eradicate governance by the people, and simultaneously resolve to remove the elitist stigma of the term progressive. Resolve to defeat tyranny masked within democracy. Resolve to bear witness to local oppression. Resolve to not be bullied by even the most dangerous and spiteful. Resolve to personally stick up for the rights and persons of those prejudiced against. Resolve to resist the so-called security state that protects the ruling class by suppressing the rights of the people. Resolve to resist a registry of Muslims or any other religion, race, minority, or opposition. Resolve to show up at protests against the hijacking of democratic government. Write letters, send emails, tweet, and speak out whenever and wherever necessary. Resolve to donate and participate in progressive causes. Work in campaigns for local, state, and national progressive candidates. Resolve to keep your head and convictions when others might temporize their own. Resolve to not be pushed around by bullies who think they have a mandate to sow and reap fear. Resolve to refute petty demagogues who will try to shout you down. Resolve to resist or shake off complacency. This is no time for it. Resolve to organize against the anti-democratic purge of not only the external forms of democracy, but also the explicit deterioration of its substance. Resolve to resist the resurgence of the nuclear arms race. We are past that insanity. Resolve to resist government and corporate oppression at work. Revive unions. Resolve to resist government control of information and suppression of a free press or any other form of speech, thought, or media. Never forget that the First Amendment is the real guardian of all the other rights and liberties guaranteed by constitutional government. Resolve to resist privatization of education. Public education preserves democracy. Resolve to resist denial of women's rights and equality. Male superiority is a sick joke. Resolve to fight for women's reproductive rights and resist attempts to abolish Roe versus Wade. Half the human race subjugating the reproductive half is ridiculously counterproductive. Resolve to resist racial, sexual, and ethnic slurs and attacks against anybody. Resolve to not remain silent when someone spouts racist, sexual, or ethnic remarks. Resolve to resist attempts to abolish environmental standards and fight to increase them for the health and preservation of our descendants and the world they will inhabit. Resolve to resist climate change denial and those who speciously espouse that denial. Resolve to ardently support affordable and competent health care for everybody. Resolve to support gun control and restraints upon those who may possess firearms, especially open carry laws and posse comitatus-style militia armament. Resolve to demand restraints upon upper-class wealth accumulation. Resolve to insist on limits of corporate influence over laws and politics. Resolve to uphold fair laws and resist unjust and prejudicial laws. Resolve to support Trump's impeachment. Resolve to hold Trump statutorily accountable for all of the lies he told in his campaign and as president. Resolve, in addition, to demand investigation of Russian connivance in the presidential election on behalf of Trump as the Siberian candidate. And in addition, in the names of fairness, discourage covert American interference in elections around the world. Resolve to help reform the Democratic Party to its essential roots by participating in local party affairs, as well as standing up to the Republican Party's pernicious and unworthy obsession for power. Resolve that Oregon, as a blue state on the upper left edge of the lower 48, act as a bastion of democratic liberties despite the presence of ravaging right-wing militias. Resolve to refuse Trump's coup d'etat presidency. Resolve to support public media through active and financial participation, and also be persistently insistent that commercial media meet its responsibilities on the public airwaves. resolved to passionately keep the promise of Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg that we are a sovereignty of the people, by the people, and for the people. Resolve that this is not a time to quail or cavil. Futures of descendants and possibly planet are at stake. Franklin Roosevelt said at his first inauguration in 1933 that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Do not be afraid of being afraid. We are entering a fearful time. Resolve to utilize your very warranted fear as soldiers do in a war, to desperately fight for life and liberty as our revolutionary ancestors fought to create freedom down to the last generation. This is Michael McCusker. I conclude with an epigram stenciled on T-shirts designed by 14-year-old Aylin Scatterfield, a student at Grant High School in Portland, Oregon in 2001, as a response to 9/11. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. And happy birthday to Joan Baez, who was born the same year I was, 1941. Both of us pre-Pearl Harbor babies. Diamonds and rust, by golly.